Black, Christian R. Larson, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Yes. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Chief Justice said is Chris Larson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin in this appeal, in this petition for review. In this case, the state of Wisconsin is the petitioner seeking reversal of a Court of Appeals decision, and we were the respondent in the Court of Appeals. This case really presents, as presented by the state, it presents two issues, but I think the first is probably the primary issue that we presented in our brief and that we'd like the court to consider. The first issue, as presented and discussed in the briefs, was the adequacy of the factual basis underlying the defendant's plea in this case to a felon in possession of a firearm charge. And the issue as presented is whether there was an adequate factual basis for the defendant's plea, and whether the judge conducted, it's kind of a related question, whether the judge conducted an adequate inquiry, if one is required at all. In a situation where the parties, as is pretty typical in state court practice, I believe, stipulated to a set of facts for purposes of entry of the plea, and that stipulation was that the court could take the facts that are outlined in the criminal complaint as true for the purpose of that hearing and use those facts then to determine whether there's a factual basis for the plea. And in such a case where those facts are stipulated, there is this set of facts, where the defendant, I may talk about it as a guilty plea, but it was a no contest plea in this case, but where the defendant acknowledges that he is guilty of the crime, where the defendant on the record and in the plea questionnaire indicates that he's waiving any potential defenses, where he stipulates to a given set of facts. In this case, the facts of the complaint that were stipulated to are that the defendant handled a firearm that was found in the bedroom of his girlfriend, a woman named Felicia Ferguson. The complaint also indicated that he made a statement to the officer that he didn't know who the gun belonged to, but he admitted that he handled the firearm. Now, the complaint also establishes that various drugs were found in this apartment beneath a mattress inside the girlfriend's bedroom. There's both marijuana and cocaine found there. The defendant also made admissions to owning the marijuana and having given it to the girlfriend in the recent past. Actually, I believe it was that same day.
Was there cocaine found under the bed as well?
Yes, I believe the complaint outlines that. There was fairly small amounts of cocaine base in individual packets that were found there. Although the defendant's admission, as I read the complaint, was that he owned the marijuana, it doesn't indicate whether the officer asked him whether the cocaine was his as well.
But the drug charge is not before us.
Yes, the drug charge is not directly before this court. The defendant only moved to withdraw his plea as to count two, I believe it was, which was the firearms charge, the felon in possession charge.
Mr. Larson, there's a lot made in the briefs about the letter that comes from Ms. Ferguson to the court. Is there anything in the record that indicates that the judge had read that letter? Does the judge in some way make that letter part of the record?
Your Honor, there is nothing explicit, as I read the record, that indicates whether the judge actually read that letter at the time of the plea hearing. He was clearly apprised of it later. As a matter of fact, I think the letter came up at the sentencing. Defense counsel brought it up fairly briefly in the sentencing comments. But there is nothing in the record that I could see that would indicate whether the judge read the letter. Now, I know it was in the record. It clearly was part of the court file. I think the records indicated that it was, I believe it was file stamped, but and it's part of the record before this court.
But at the plea hearing itself, no one called attention to that letter or discussed the letter?
That's exactly right, yes. And I think that's a key fact to our argument is that, for instance, had it been a case where defense counsel had perhaps raised the issue and said, raised some question about the factual basis, well, Judge, there's this letter here that we're concerned about. We have some question about whether you know, we can really stipulate to this given set of facts or whether my client's guilty, because there's this letter here that indicates that the girlfriend owned the gun. And her version, although counsel argues my opponent argues that letter is really consistent with the complaint, I don't really think it is. It adds a really different spin, almost starts to present a potential defense to the firearms charge.
Well, what's the defense? You think the letter hurts the state?
I think it does start to get toward, arguably gets toward a defense. I think that one of the problems with the letter, though, is that the letter is still somewhat vague as to exactly how the defendant came into possession.
How does it hurt you?
Excuse me?
How does it hurt you?
Well, I think what the letter does, because it indicates, of course, ownership is really not the question in possession, but it could support an argument that, I think part of the problem is that the letter, again, is incomplete, but it could support either an argument that there's not sufficient evidence that the defendant intended to control the firearm, or that it presents some sort of defense because he had either an innocent intent, which we, of course, argue in our brief, still does not, it wouldn't rise to the level of providing a defense or undercutting his criminal intent or the intent required for a felon in possession charge. But it's a different set of facts, and I think it, depending on any additional gloss that may be added to the letter, it starts to move in the direction of the defendant trying to present a defense.
Well, now that raises the question as to whether the complaint, which the parties agreed the court should look at for the facts, right?
Yes.
The only fact about the gun, the pistol, was, if I'm reading it right, and it's one sentence, defendant further stated he had handled the pistol on Monday in Felicia's bedroom, but he doesn't know who the gun belongs to. Now, is that enough to show the elements of possession, whether it's actual or constructive?
Well, Your Honor, as to actual possession, I would argue that for these purposes, for purposes of accepting a plea, yes, that is enough. It is certainly bare bones, no question. But I think what the court's obligation at the plea hearing really is not to delve into whether the entire story of the crime at that point to see whether there is a potential defense. I think the key is the defendant admitting to enough? Are there some facts that support the charge? So they ensure the defendant is not pleading to something that really doesn't exist.
Do you think that admitting that you handled the gun equals knowing control?
I think there's enough to support that inference. Whether this, in and of itself, that brief sentence would satisfy the government's burden beyond a reasonable doubt, I would have to concede that that probably is not sufficient for something like that. But in the context of a plea hearing where the defendant is admitting to his guilt, he's saying that, yes, these facts prove me guilty. Everyone's in agreement that he handled the firearm, which even under the ordinary, there's a Black's Law Dictionary definition that indicates that the word handle, the first definition is to control. And that's the definition of possession, of actual possession.
The time factor makes no difference if he handled it for 5 minutes, 5 seconds, or shorter period of time. And there's no argument here that he didn't know it was a gun.
Exactly, and I think that would be a really different case.
That's in the letter. If you believe the letter,
right?
That he didn't know it was a gun.
The letter, he didn't even claim he didn't know it was a gun. I don't think in any of the versions. Either in the letter, his statements in the pre-sentence report, is there ever any claim that he didn't believe or know that it was a gun?
Well, under the statute, is it sufficient to establish actual possession if an individual holds the gun for any amount of time, including a fleeting moment?
like Justice, the chief passes me a note to give to Justice Bradley. Am I in possession of that note? Is that what the legislature intended under this statute?
Well, I think with firearms, it really, in part because the cases from this court have indicated it's a strict liability crime, and part of the reason for a strict liability crime is then you don't have to get into proving what a person's motive, what his purpose was. It's simply a bright-line rule. If you're a felon, you're not to touch a weapon. You're not to intentionally touch, pick up a weapon. And I think it really fits within that rationale. So the firearms cases, I would say, are somewhat different, perhaps, than other possession cases. It's the definition, I think, of possession is still the same. You still have to establish that the person had physical control, even if, yeah, or possession. I think possession defined as control.
So if he looks at the gun and says to the lady, "Why? What are you doing with this gun? Get rid of it." He's not in possession.
I would agree.
But if he picks it up and says, "What are you doing with this gun? Get rid of it," and then sets it back down on the bed, that's possession for purposes of the statute.
Huh? I would contend that it is. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Sounds a little rough, though, doesn't it?
It's a literal reading, but it's, I think it's a reading that's intended by the statute. It's intended to create a bright line.
Mm-hmm.
I think in many cases, felons are advised of that, and they're even advised that they shouldn't be in the same room with a gun, even though that may not necessarily establish possession. But I would argue that that's kind of our secondary argument in this case, is that even if you assume the facts as the Court of Appeals assumed them, which throws in the additional facts from the Ferguson letter, that still would constitute actual possession. It's probably a pretty rare case.
If you're talking about a possession, we had a case a while ago, not directly on point, but let's keep the gun. I don't like you to keep the gun in the bed. He never handled it, but put the gun up in the Cheerios box in the cupboard. Didn't touch the gun. Here he actually touched it. And the letter says, well, he said to get rid of it. But he, in my example, he's just saying he didn't touch the gun. He just told somebody else, put the gun up in the cereal box. So that would be a little more difficult, but it still would be possession. But, you know, you have to have it on you.
You certainly do not for constructive possession. And I think you're right. That is a little more difficult situation, although I think a strong argument could be made that by directing someone else where to place a gun, he's exercising control. And there is that element in both actual and constructive possession. I think there has to be some minimum intent or purpose in exercising control. But beyond that, there doesn't have to be some sort of evil purpose or memory.
You know, we have a long line of cases that suggest that if the integrity of the plea hearing process is questionable, then you can go outside of the record of the plea hearing in order to show, for instance, that the plea was indeed knowingly made and voluntarily made. What is the body of law that suggests that what appears to be an otherwise knowing and voluntary plea can be attacked by going outside of the plea record, can be undermined as opposed to supported?
Well, Your Honor, our argument is there really is no such body of law which would support that approach. Now, in a motion to withdraw a guilty plea, of course, you can always attempt to make other arguments that there was a manifest injustice, and you might be able to imagine a situation where some newly discovered evidence or even a change in the law, something along that line, could change the calculus as to whether this given set of facts would constitute a legal violation. But I think the Merrifield case that we've cited, it's out of the Court of Appeals from last year, really articulates this well, and that's, you have to look at the function of what the plea hearing is.
Would your position be the same And if, in this case, if the contents of the complaint did not have the sentence that does exist, that sentence being that the defendant Purdy stated that he handled the pistol on Monday in Felicia's bedroom, but that he doesn't know who the gun belongs to. If that sentence was taken out and instead in the criminal complaint, the sentence was stated and that the girlfriend reported that the defendant handled the pistol, comma, but only touched once, looking at it after I purchased it. And that at that moment he said to me that I didn't need it. What would your position be if those, if the second sentence was in the complaint in lieu of the first?
I think that starts to present a harder question, but I would also argue, though, again, in the context of a plea hearing, that would be sufficient. And the reason is I think, again, going back to the purpose of a plea hearing, as long as there are facts there that support an inference, support a reasonable inference that the defendant has done conduct that's consistent with the crime, that's really what the court's obligation is. Now, might it be in that situation where you seemingly have you have a statement that he touched the gun, but then you have a pretty strong statement that there might be some sort of explanation or something rising to the level of defense? I think you can see cases where maybe that would trigger a duty to inquire further, and there may be those situations. And that one, you know, may come a little closer to that situation. But again, looking at the plea hearing, what the defendant is coming in and saying is that I've had the advice of counsel, I've decided that I'm going to plead guilty, the court can use this set of facts as the factual basis. And oftentimes that may be in a complaint, especially if it's a lengthy one, that does contain contradictory statements from different witnesses. And some may go against the government's position a little bit, some may favor it. And I don't think it's the court's duty to go back and then sort that out and say, well, you know, defendant, I notice there's a statement in here that seems to suggest you may not have had the X intent, or you may have a justification for doing this, or self-defense. I don't think there's any body of law that says the court has to explore that with the defendant. Now, I know that I think some judges may do that under certain circumstances. In your hypothetical, that may have well led a judge to do that, especially in a shorter, less complicated complaint.
Well, what about 971081B that says that before the court accepts the plea, it shall make such inquiry, it satisfies it that the defendant in fact committed the crime charged?
Yes.
So you think that the judge can be satisfied with a conflicting complaint that might indicate privilege or defense and doesn't have to make any inquiry?
I believe so, Your Honor.
That's the state's position.
That's the state's position. Now, isn't
your position that the state can just accept the guilty plea?
Well, no, I think what the government, the court still has to do, though, it has to find that there are facts in the, you know, a reasonable construction of the facts may be one way to put it, but there have to be facts in the complaint that support the crime. Because that's the purpose, is to make sure that the defendant isn't pleading to something that there's no factual basis for it. I guess I'm stating it conclusory there, but there has to be facts from the stipulation, from whatever set of facts that you're going from, that show that he's guilty. And, you know, a complaint by its nature, again, may contain conflicting information. Depending on the nature of the conflict, I think it does at some point reach a case-by-case determination. It may well be that there would be some further duty to inquire, but in this case, there was no indication of really any sort of defense. It indicated the defendant handled the firearm, and he's a convicted felon. So certainly in this case, the judge didn't have that duty.
But does handling a firearm give you a fact?
I take your point that it's somewhat conclusory, although...
Conclusory, and you don't know what happened. It doesn't tell you anything about it.
Although...
Other than maybe that he touched it. may tell that it touched it, but it doesn't tell you anything else. How can that be sufficient facts to satisfy the defendant in fact committed the crime when what you need is possess means that the defendant knowingly had actual physical control of a firearm? That's what the jury instruction would be.
Right.
So that's the instruction that the judge has in mind mm-hmm. when she decides the case.
Yes. And I would submit, Your Honor, that although it is, again, somewhat bare bones, it certainly is sufficient because it describes a person who's handling, if you use the dictionary definition of handling, one definition I looked at, again, I think it's 6th edition of Black's, talks about handling, meaning one of the definitions is to control an item. And the definition of possession is simply that he knowingly, we've got the knowingly element, but then he exercises control. So it's, again, it and I think also, too, there is the context of the fact that there were also drugs found in the apartment.
And drugs go with guns, right?
Well,
according to the state.
That's more, I guess, a constructive possession argument. Although it's hard to, you know, we don't know for sure. The judge didn't say, well, I find this sufficient under actual possession, or I find this sufficient under constructive possession theory. So we argue that. Yes, and our position is that it would have been sufficient under constructive possession theory, at least as set forth in the complaint. Now, if you were to add Felicia Ferguson's letter to it, I think that tends to undercut a constructive possession theory. But again, our position is that really the court's duty is not to go further and to look for other items that may be in the record.
Well, just on the face of the complaint, it seems to me the state has to rely on, I have to withdraw that because ownership is not the significant factor. Does this complaint indicate it was found in somebody else's apartment?
Yes, it does. It
okay.
does.
So then that does raise a question of constructive handling.
Yes, and it's
possession.
Right, and on that theory, he did admit that the drugs that were found underneath the mattress where the gun was also found were his,
but not the gun.
Is that proof? Yeah, is that proof beyond a reasonable doubt? Probably not, but is it enough for a judge when a defendant's pleading guilty to possession and waiving defenses?
Well, it certainly is enough to, if he says they were his drugs, that is enough for him to
go
convicted of that offense.
Yes.
Whether it's an intent to sell depends on how many drugs were there, and that's a reasonable inference we've accepted.
True. Okay. Yeah, I don't want to concede that this wouldn't be enough to prove him guilty, but
I think not.
No. So if I heard that coming out of my mouth, but that wasn't what I wanted to concede.
Exactly.
So.
What do you do here when, for instance, the definition of handle would encompass what's said in the letter, you know, to touch? The definition of handle would encompass holding in your hand. Does the court have an obligation to ferret out the word handle means when it's in a complaint and there's a plea?
I don't think that it does. Now, again, depending on the particular facts, it may be good practice and it may be even mandated by, if there's enough conflicting evidence, enough question that, you know, it appears that this person may not have committed the crime. But in a complaint like this, where it simply says the person handled a firearm, and there's no indication that there's some other defense that's going to be presented, then I don't think there is that additional duty.
Well, wait a second. Doesn't a guilty plea, and by extension a no contest plea, constitute a concession on the part of the defendant that all reasonable inferences arising out of the facts and all conflicts in the facts can be resolved in favor of a finding of guilt?
Absolutely. I think that's a good way of putting it. And that's one of the reasons why I think the question, even if there's conflicting evidence in the complaint, that certainly can support a factual basis, because The defendant is saying, here's a set of facts, I'm agreeing that this is the given set of facts, and then it shows that I'm guilty. And so even if there are conflicts, I think...
And I acknowledge that I'm waiving any and all defenses that may be available to me, and I understand how the evidence proves me guilty. That's right on the guilty plea questionnaire, is it not?
It is, yes, exactly. And I think that's what our position is. It's a legal question in comparing the complaint to the law, to the elements of the offense, but it's also added to the fact that it's a guilty plea where the defendant says, yes, these facts do prove me guilty, I am guilty, he has the assistance of counsel, and he's waived defenses.
Is the hearing on the plea a part of the record here?
Yes, it is. Actually, Your Honor, we did reproduce it as an appendix to our brief, to the entire plea hearing.
I was trying to find it.
Started at the very end of the red brief, our opening brief. It's labeled page 128 of the
appendix. Okay, that's page 23 of the brief.
I think it's
2016. Okay, I haven't gotten to it. This one yet. All right, that's the totality of it.
That's the totality of the guilty plea hearing. Yes.
Right. If this gun was laying on the floor and the defendant saw a 2-year-old baby crawling towards the gun, he went over there and took it to the Cheerios box. Just kicked it out of the way. Two-month-old or 4-month-old or something like that. Is that possession?
That may very well not be actual possession. Now, it may be constructive possession if he's controlling that firearm before the baby's going through it.
Okay, he takes it and places it up on the top shelf. So he's actually got this hand on and puts it on the top shelf so that the child can't get to it.
And the way I would analyze that, I would suggest, is that when he physically handles it, he meets the elements of possession, but then there may be a defense there.
But what defense?
Well,
necessity requires natural physical forces.
How about the privilege? Defense of others?
Would privilege do it?
I think there's a...
There's an exegesis of privilege in the dissent, I think.
Yes, exactly. There's an outline of every privilege, and I think we repeated that in our... actually, there's one that's... Oh, never mind.
Perhaps you should pick up the baby.
Put the child in the Cheerios box.
Right. The necessity. There is the necessity defense, but I think you're right. That requires physical forces. But then there's defense of persons or property under any of the circumstances described in this other statute. Typical of the defenses too is that there's no other reasonable alternative at the time to taking this action as opposed to violating the law. So, depending in your scenario, that may well support or approach a defense. You can also do it. There's also various common law defenses that have been recognized by other jurisdictions. And
maybe jury nullification,
right? Well, how about underprivilege? I mean, you have sub 3. The defendant had no reasonable alternative to possessing a firearm or reason to believe that he or she had no such alternative. In other words, the defendant didn't have a chance to, not to.
Right.
That's privilege.
What's up?
3.
When the actor's conduct is in good faith.
So that's why I asked you about whether that you have the entire record.
Yes.
This judge here asked nothing other than, you understand that I'm going to use the facts in the complaint? Yes. And then there was just a denial about the cocaine. You understand by signing the form, you'd be telling me you wish to give all constitutional rights, you're doing it freely, you don't have to prove it, I'm free to sentence. There's no no statement here of the elements of the crime, nothing.
Oh,
yeah. Just saying, I read the complaint and I find a factual basis.
True, and although, go ahead. I would point out, too, that they do indicate that there is the plea questionnaire that the defendant went over signed.
I know, and that says, do you understand the all the elements and that there are no defenses and so on.
Right, exactly. And that he waives defenses, that he acknowledges that the crime does...
So if you file, in effect, if you file this plea questionnaire, the judge has no obligation to make any other inquiry.
Well, I think he still has to make the personal inquiries that are required by the Wisconsin statute, which to ensure that it's knowingly and voluntarily made. None of those were specifically challenged in this case. Again,
all it was asked is it voluntary made. So that's the limit of the requirements.
Although I think the overall context of the plea hearing, again, the way that he makes these responses is something that the judge typically will look at to see if he feels it's a voluntary plea. Representations of defense counsel are included in that. So it was a relatively short, but I think in my limited experience,
bare
I don't
bones,
have a lot.
Would you say bare bones?
Well, I know I used that phrase when I referred to the statement about the gun. I'm not sure I would say the same with respect to the plea. I think it may have been relatively short, but not uncommon. And certainly, I think if you look at it in its whole, it touches the relevant bases. It covers the plea questionnaire. It advises him about that he's waiving constitutional rights. I know every judge has a different practice, and depending on volume and things, of course, I'm sure the court's sensitive to those issues. But again, it's really the challenge here was to the facts, too. There's never any claim that he wasn't aware of the nature of the charge. There was something involuntary going on here. Okay, I think my red light's on. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Mr. Holzman, representing Mr. Black.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Justices. My name is Michael Holzman. I represent the defendant appellant, Tyron Black. And we're here before this court to ask that this court affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals, which held two things, that the actions of Mr. Black on the date in question did not constitute possession under the law, either statute or by jury instruction or by case law, and also that the actions of the trial judge in this matter did not fulfill his duty under 971.08 to have a reasonable, meaningful duty of inquiry to determine whether or not the guilty plea that Mr. Black entered on that date, or the no contest plea, was based on sufficient facts in the record. As to the first point, Justices, I think a lot of the questions have dealt with some of the issues about possession in this case. It appears to me when I look at the facts in this case, I've got a situation where there's an attempt by Mr. Black, based on both Ms. Ferguson's letter prior to the plea hearing, and also based on the subsequent evidence that we attached to our response to the state's brief, which indicate that there is an avoidance of possession in this case. Ms. Ferguson's letter, which was, I believe, file stamped, part of the court record, and available for the review of the trial judge, which seemed to be ignored in terms of the actual trial and plea transcript, did specifically state that Mr. Black gave her the gun back immediately, or gave her back the gun and said, we don't need it. Subsequently, there is records prior to sentencing that Mr. Black said additional information saying, let's get rid of the gun. I'm a felon in possession. I want to get rid of this gun. I think in this situation, it's kind of like, and some of the examples used by the court I think are relevant. So you're driving a car and somebody throws a gun in your lap and you look at it and you throw it out the window. Well, according to the state's definition, this momentary or even second possession for a few seconds of this weapon, okay, immediately followed by an attempt to get rid of it, or to get rid of it by throwing it out the window, would constitute possession.
Yeah, but Mr. Holtz, but that's a jury argument, isn't it? I mean, why did he plead no contest if he wanted to argue that the appropriate inference to draw from these facts was that this was avoidance, not possession?
Because I don't know if really, I think it deals with the duty of inquiry on behalf of the court, that the court had enough information available to it to know that there are some question marks and red flags here. The defendant, I don't think, can be expected to specifically know the definitions of possession.
But he's represented by counsel. He and his counsel admitted that the handling that was described in his confession to the police was sufficient to constitute possession, which is an element of this offense. Why doesn't that end the inquiry?
Well, I think that first of all, we filed an ineffective assistance to counsel request for an evidentiary hearing in our initial brief. But I think that...
Did you get that hearing?
Well, the Court of Appeals granted our motion, our appeal based on other grounds and didn't address this issue. And I think that if the court finds that there was no possession here, but finds that the court didn't reach its duty of inquiry, we'd ask for an evidentiary hearing concerning a marketing hearing concerning ineffective assistance to counsel. But I don't know if we need to reach that point. I think the real issue here is the duty of inquiry of the court. The court is like a gatekeeper. The court is intended to protect the interests of the defendant, to make sure that the facts justify the plea, and also to watch out for ineffectiveness, to make sure the lawyer does his or her job in protecting the defendant, to make sure they give a proper factual, have a factual basis for the plea. And I don't think the court did that in this case. I think that the court really did a bare bones, sketchy, boilerplate, yes. And I think one of the things that's very telling in the Court of Appeals' decision is that they said, well, there aren't any facts that justify the plea. And I don't think really there are.
When we look to see if there are facts to justify a pleading after a series of hearings, can the court look at all of them, the appellate court, all of these proceedings?
Absolutely. And I think that the Thomas case is quite clear that the court has to look at the totality of the circumstances.
Well, pages 17 and 18 of the record, and it looks to me this is part of sentencing, but it's not quite clear. It's part of your post-conviction relief motion, but it's an Exhibit G. And here's what it says. It's apparently counsel for the defendant is speaking. The gun, as the court is well aware, Ms. Ferguson indicates she purchased it on the street a few days before, and that she it was because she felt unsafe. And she is confused, Judge, as to the state's ability to prosecute a felon in possession case. I've explained it to her. I've explained it to Mr. Black. They do not have to prove ownership, just that he possessed it at some time. And he admits he did handle the gun for a very short period of time when Ms. Ferguson first purchased it, and he advised her to get rid of it, and that he didn't want the gun around. So what is that from? What am I reading from?
That, I believe that's from the sentencing transcript.
Okay.
And I guess the couple of points I could make in reference to that comment is that the attorney involved really gave the wrong advice to your client. That simply possessing in these facts, given the fact that he immediately threw it back in the arms of Ms. Ferguson, is not sufficient to constitute possession in our view.
Do we have that he immediately threw the gun back in the arms of Ms. Ferguson?
Well, the only thing we know are the from the exhibits that were the two letters to Ms. Ferguson. I don't know immediately, Your Honor. That's correct. But there is a reference here to a very short period of time. There is also reference to a brief period of time in the statement in the pre-sentence report from Mr. Black. So we don't know the exact number of amount of time, but it does appear from the totality of the circumstances of this evidence, including the pre-sentence report, including the two letters from Ms. Ferguson, and including the statements of counsel here, that the reviewing courts at least had enough information to support the What we're saying is that this wasn't just an attempt to avoid as opposed to an attempt to accept possession on behalf of Mr. Black.
Could I ask you a question? The Court of Appeals majority three times says that Mr. Black told her to get rid of it, meaning the gun. Where is that?
I think that that's in the pre-sentence report, which I attached to the brief that I filed. Okay, and that was available to the court prior to sentencing, not available to the court prior to the plea. And that's where Mr. Black made a statement that I gave the gun back to Ms. Ferguson, told her to get rid of it, said I'm a felon in possession, and that's where that came from.
Now, certainly that was not available to the court at the time the plea was taken.
No, it was not available at the time of the plea, but it was available to the reviewing courts when they reviewed whether or not there were sufficient facts in the record to justify the plea on reversal. I think that the Thomas case establishes you can look at all the record to determine whether or not a guilty plea should be withdrawn and whether there's a manifest injustice. So that's why I brought that in, because it deals with the reviewing courts and determining the determination of whether or not there are sufficient facts to justify the plea.
So a defendant can backpedal on a previous confession that he has admitted can be used to authenticate and establish his guilt in a guilty plea position. He can do that in the pre-sentence. He can do that in his right of allocution and unravel the entire process on a post-conviction motion.
Well, I don't know if this is the same situation, Judge Justice, about as with a confession. And I think that you've got here a situation where there's a lack of detail in the initial plea.
Well, no question about that. But it's a confession. Okay. Yeah, I'm a felon. Yeah, I handled that gun. And yes, I'm agreeing, Judge, you can consider that as sufficient to find me guilty of this offense.
But I think that the court has to do more than just stop at a bare-bones guilty plea where there are no details or facts. They've got to look at the totality of the circumstances, which the trial judge had the first letter from Ms. Ferguson, which seemed to amplify and clarify this what this handling meant.
So a judge has to make sure that he has gone through every piece of paper in the file at the time of the acceptance of a guilty plea, before he accepts the guilty plea.
In my view, it is the judge's obligation to look at the entire record before him.
And wouldn't that grind the criminal courts to a halt?
Well, I don't believe so. I believe that in this case, it is a very limited record.
Not in every case.
No, that's not in every case.
You know, the judge has a preliminary hearing transcript in the file, and the parties have agreed that the court can use the criminal complaint to establish the defendant's guilt for purposes of a guilty plea. Does that mean the judge has to stop and read the preliminary hearing transcript and the complaint before the plea can be accepted?
I think that the court, based on the circumstances of each case, has to make a determination as to what is a reasonable inquiry. In this case, you've got a bare-bones complaint, you've got a record which is very limited and very easy to review, and you've got basically a letter from Ms. Ferguson who said the gun was hers, and all he had to do is ask one question of the defendant, well, is this true that you basically gave it back?
That was a no-contest plea. We don't do that in no-contest pleas. The defendant is choosing not to contest the charges. He's not... You know, it's not the same as a guilty plea where you make personal inquiry of the defendant. Is this what you did, Mr. Defendant?
Well,
you can't do that in a no-contest plea.
Then he could say, well, maybe there's a basis for the no-contest plea. There's not enough on the record. Maybe that's why he did a no-contest plea. We don't know. These are all red flags that the trial court judge should have looked at to alert himself that he had to serve his gatekeeper role to make sure the rights were protected. In this case, it's not in every case where the facts are so limited that the judge needs to ask that question. But in this case, I think it's quite clear that the judge should have done a little more than ask for questions that ask for yes, yes, yes responses with absolutely no factual basis for what this handling meant.
Counsel, did the court give the defendant the plea hearing the elements of the offense?
I don't believe he did, Your Honor.
No.
I don't believe he did. I think that what the state attached is what happened.
What the entire
transcript of that hearing is in the red.
Were the elements of the offense in any way incorporated into the plea advisement and the waiver of rights form?
No. I think that the plea advisement, waiver of rights form is attached in the red in the state submission as well.
I mean, it was, that's what I thought in looking at the record before me, because I was musing upon the idea, well, if he'd gone through the elements of the offense, maybe this issue would have unfolded or developed. What, if anything, is the consequence of a court, of a defendant entering a no contest plea without the record showing that he knows the elements of the offense?
Well, I always think it's probably good practice for those to be explained to the defendant. In some courts, they do attach the copy of the jury instructions.
Does the law in the state of Wisconsin require that the plea hearing, whether the court do it orally or that they be attached to the plea advisement and waiver of rights form, that the plea hearing include an advisement of the elements of the offense before it can be a valid plea?
I don't believe so. But I think in this case, there are enough questions that are raised by Ms. Ferguson's letter, the bare bones nature of the complaint, to raise a red flag in the judge's mind so we can ask one or two questions about what happened. And I don't think he did that. And I think that the judge has a responsibility, notwithstanding the heavy load that the judge has in going through cases, but to do more than just a perfunctory plea, and to do more than just the bare bones, especially in a case like this when he should have known.
Does it help you or hurt you that the judge said, why are we using December 29th for the second count?
I don't know if it has, I'm not sure the reference that the court had to the, is that the second count, the finger of the gun count? Why are we using that date?
Why are we using December 29th for the second count, counsel? Admission in the complaint, judge, involves possession of pistol on Monday, which was 2 days earlier, December 29th.
Well, I think that is the time. I don't know if it helps or hurts. Maybe I'm missing something, but it seems that just provides the date that the pistol was actually touched by client.
Well, he wasn't touching it when the police was searching the apartment. Or
No. This was prior to that time.
He was protecting the gun and the narcotics.
Right. And I think the issue of constructive possession that's been brought up is really reaching, simply because he indicated that he gave it to Ms. Ferguson and it was found under her bed in her apartment. So that seems to say that, yes, he did give it to her and didn't want it. It seems to support that from a factual basis.
In the preliminary hearing, there were two police officers, if I'm reading this right, one of them on examination said, Detective, when you spoke with Mr. Black, question, you indicated he admitted he had touched the pistol, is that correct? Answer, that's correct. Question, and did he say exactly how he had touched it and how that occurred? Answer, he said he was basically looking at it and was handling it. Question, and did he indicate to you where that occurred? Answer, yes, in the bedroom. And the pistol you found was the same one, and that was the extent of the testimony about handling.
Right, I think that's the extent of the testimony until we get to Ms. Ferguson's letter, which I think clarifies what this handling was, and also as to the pre-sentence report and the statements of Mr. Black's counsel in sentencing, which further clarifies the totality of the facts.
Mr. Holzman, I'm looking at the guilty plea questionnaire and waiver of rights form. Do you have a copy of that?
Yes, I do.
Paragraph 4 certainly seems relevant to the issues before the court. It says, I have read or have read to me the criminal complaint and the information in this case. I understand what I am charged with, what the penalties are, and why I have been charged. I also understand the elements of the offense and their relationship to the facts in this case and how the evidence establishes my guilt. Isn't that significant?
Well, I think it's putting the, in a case like this, it's putting the defendant in a very difficult position. Because I don't think his attorney necessarily understood what the elements of the facts were.
Is there anything on the record that would indicate that?
I don't think that his attorney necessarily understood what was going on in this by some of the comments he made about saying that the handling in these circumstances constituted the offense of possession of a weapon.
Is there any law that says it doesn't?
That it doesn't what?
Constitute possession?
What, that handling the weapon in this way doesn't?
That handling the weapon, that's what we have in the record here, that he admits handling the weapon. We don't have all the details about how that occurred, but he admits to the police handling the weapon. Is there any law that supports the theory that that is insufficient to constitute possession for felon in possession?
Well, there is law in other states, as I cited in my brief.
Is there any law in Wisconsin?
As far as I know, there is no law that has specifically addressed that issue.
Then how can you accuse the trial counsel of not understanding the law?
Because it seems to me to be quite equitable, and to say there's got to be some kind of intent to possess a weapon based on the jury instruction that says there's got to be knowingly, actually possess something. And I think the issue of knowing brings in the issue of intent to some degree. And I think the trial counsel should have understood that, as in other jurisdictions in Utah, Arizona. And
is there anything in the complaint that would give rise to an inference that this was an accidental instead of an intentional handling?
Well, I think that the trial counsel had access, as did the court, to the letter from Ms. Ferguson. She argued at the sentencing that it was a brief.
What in Ms. Ferguson's letter establishes that this was an accidental instead of an intentional handling?
I don't know. Accidental is a kind of a confusing word.
It's the alternative to intentional, right?
Well,
under these circumstances, you either did it intentionally, volitionally, or accidentally, right?
I guess if somebody puts something in your hand and you give it back, I mean, you can call that accidental. You know, I don't know. I don't know if the terminology is, I think that's what happened in this situation. And I think the cases in other jurisdictions establish that situation that I've described, an innocent handling of a weapon, okay, where you get it and then give it back, that would be a defense to a gun possession charge.
But that's not the law of Wisconsin.
Well, I'm suggesting, Your Honor, that the court consider this to be the law in this
situation. Well, I understand that, but that's not the law, and it was not the law at the time that this plea was taken and this trial counsel did her job, right?
Well, I'm just suggesting that the trial counsel should have listened to her client a little more about the circumstances of this, which I guess was brought up in the pre-sentence report at the very latest. I'm sure it was brought up earlier based on her prior motion, and she should have looked at some other case law. So, I mean, that's the basis for this allegation.
Counsel, if you had a jury verdict here, and the jury heard all the facts, how many moments he touched the gun, how he found the gun under the mattress, or where he found the gun, and what he said and what he did, and the jury heard all of that, and the jury came back and convicted him after hearing the instructions under 1343, that's the standard instruction. You think that the court would overturn that as that no credible facts to support it?
But
as a matter of law, your client, that's another way of saying it, as a matter of your law, your client is not guilty.
Well, if he briefly handled it to get rid of it, I think that it would be a matter of law that he's not guilty, that it's an innocent handling.
Well, there's a credibility issue of whether you believe him.
Right. I mean, but the only one thing,
so
too, is
that the jury didn't believe him.
Well, one thing, too, is that the only witnesses to this are Ms. Ferguson and Mr. Black. not any other police officers, or it wasn't found...
The jury doesn't believe either one of them, thinks that that's not exactly the way it may have happened, and convicts them. You don't think that they could do that?
Well, the jury could always find that there's no credible witnesses at all, but they'd have to base it on this... I think it'd be very difficult for the jury to do that, but clearly they could determine it based on credibility. I think in this case, some things have been brought up about whether these facts are contested or not contested.
Right.
And you got to look at who's testifying to this. It's Black and Ferguson. Those are the people, and there's no.
That's the whole point about a no contest plea or a guilty plea. You might be able to beat it with a jury verdict. You might not be able to beat it. If you decide you're going to confess or admit and or plea, whichever way you want to put it, and take the consequences. I mean, that is the choice when you plead guilty, that you're waiving the obligation of the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. So the question here is whether there isn't enough here. It's the question of whether the obligation of the court to make inquiry to satisfy itself then in fact committed the crime charge.
And I think, Justice, that you've got to look at, first of all, the totality of the circumstances in this. You can't just put blinders on and just look at the plea colloquy or the plea questionnaire. You've got to look at everything in the court record. And I think it's very easy to do, unlike in the Merrifield case cited by counsel. It's very easy to do in this case. And I don't think the court did that. They should have been alerted, given these facts, that something was up. They should have asked a question. They should have looked at Ferguson's letter. And they didn't. And as a result, my client entered a no-contest plea to facts that I don't believe would establish his guilt.
Counsel, what I touched upon this earlier, and it just occurred to me in oral argument, so I don't have this looked at or researched. But what do you do, or what should the court do, if anything? I remember on the trial court, when that State versus Bangert came down, under 97108, you have to make sure that the defendant understands the nature of the offense. And the way you did that, as a trial court judge, especially after Bangert, is to make sure that you advise them. In fact, some of the judges in continuing judicial education devise these forms. Here are all the elements of the offenses. Make sure, judges, that you read these to the defendant so he knows the nature of the defense. Otherwise, facially, you're going to have an inadequate plea colloquy. And then some others said, well, let's just take those babies and attach them to the plea advisement waiver of rights form. You got it in there, and you got enough. Otherwise, you facially have an inadequate plea colloquy. Now, Bankard, as I recall it, and I my recollection may be wrong, says, okay, but if the plea colloquy, the record is inadequate, then you can go outside the record. So you can say, okay, get the affidavit of the attorney, and the attorney says, well, when he first came into my office 2 months beforehand or 2 minutes before the plea was going to be taken on the day of the trial, that I went over the elements of the offense with him. Good, you put that affidavit in, then you have enough in the record. Otherwise, you have an inadequate plea hearing that doesn't meet the mandates of 97108. The only reason I bring this up is because my sense is if you go over the elements of the offense, then you don't have the problem, or may not have the problem, that we're being faced with here today. My question is, what, if anything, does this difference make if the record does not show an adequate plea hearing with regard to the nature of the offense?
Well, I think we had a bare-bones plea hearing in this case.
Well, there's a difference between plea bare-bones and adequate. I'm talking about adequate under the law.
Well, I think you've got to look at the totality of the circumstances under the Thomas case and look at everything to determine if it was adequate. One of the things that the Thomas case points out is that in determining whether there's an adequate financial base, factual basis for a guilty plea or a no-contest plea, the court has to exercise its duty of inquiry. And they use the word, the court uses the words, must guarantee that the facts justify the plea.
I think I'm not making myself clear, so let me interrupt you. And it's,
sure, please.
And that is, if this record is inadequate to establish the defendant was advised of the nature of the offense as the law requires, what, if anything, do we do with that?
Well, if it's inadequate to advise him, I think we do what the Court of Appeals did. And I think Bangert is very applicable, and the procedures that are recommended in Bangert are very applicable to this.
You didn't raise that. That's not been argued.
No,
that's not been
and that's my, I guess that's my error in not raising Bangert.
I'm not saying it is.
No,
but
I think
sure
that's a really, Bangert and its other cases relating to it are quite applicable in setting the procedure. They also talk about the totality of the circumstances concerning the voluntariness of the plea, which I think is quite applicable to the facts in this case as well, where the court had a duty to look at the totality of circumstances. And I think it, like I said, it dropped the ball. So I think Bangert is quite applicable. We've got some of the procedures where the burden shifts, as in Bangert, are applicable to here. But I think you've got to start from scratch in this case, as the Court of Appeals said, because there's a manifest injustice in my client pleading, entering a no-contest plea based on insufficient facts.
Now, what about your statement that you sought to upset this plea by ineffective assistance of counsel? Is that still, suppose you lose this case here, and the court says, no, you can't withdraw on manifest injustice. We don't have before us ineffective assistance of counsel. We don't have a Mockner hearing, as I understand it. So we don't have any facts to show ineffective assistance of counsel. Counsel may have been quite effective, may have told them everything, may have said, look, you have a chance here on possession of beating the rap. We have a chance that the jury is going to convict. Could go either way. The law is unclear. We don't have that many possession cases. Other cases, so enough thing, laid it all out, and the guy said, let's get rid of this, okay? So what happens to you? Do you still have an ineffective assistance of counsel issue?
Well, the only basis, and I think we've dealt with this in some of the questions from Justice Sykes, is we raised it in our Appellant's brief initially, and the Court of Appeals didn't feel a need to address the issue because...
Right, does this go back to the Court of Appeals on the ineffective assistance of counsel? Or does it go back to the trial court on ineffective assistance of counsel? Did you raise the ineffective assistance of trial counsel in the trial court?
In the trial court, in our motion for post-conviction relief, yes.
And what was that?
They denied it, saying that it was this was possession, and we didn't even have to address the issue. So that was raised throughout the proceedings up to the Court of Appeals.
Now, those hearings are in here too, aren't they?
They should be.
On the ineffective on the motion before the court, that seemed to me to be, if I was reading the right thing, quite short too.
Right.
Do you know offhand what the reference to the record is? I'll check it. I'll look at that. So he didn't have an evidentiary hearing.
No, he denied my request for a Mockner hearing.
What was that because, though, it was tied to your legal argument pertaining to what constitutes possession, which is a legal issue, doesn't require fact-finding at a Mockner hearing?
That is correct.
Okay.
And I think it would only be applicable in the event that issue is substantiated and the trial counsel didn't advise his...
But that would be under a Mockner.
Right.
Okay. All right. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Larson.
Okay. I think my time is up, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think I may have used all my time too, but just to follow up on the last point that the Chief Justice was talking about, The circuit court's decision is contained starting at page 116 of our appendix to the red brief. And that addresses the original motion to withdraw the guilty plea. It takes up most of two pages, goes in a little bit into a third page, again starting at page 116. But then at page 117, I would just note for the court that in addition to ruling as a legal matter that the allegation of handling is sufficient to constitute possession, the court also denied the Mockner hearing, although it doesn't specifically address the Mockner hearing. It indicated that the defendant offered insufficient facts to support his version of what occurred, essentially, saying that the claim was self-serving, conclusory, and without support. Now, that's an issue.
He makes a conclusion of law that a hardly unintentional possession of a weapon was still possession. That was his legal conclusion.
Yes, I think based on what was presented in the motion.
How does that fit with possess means a defendant knowingly had actual physical control?
Yes.
And a hurried, unintentional possession was still possession. How does that fit with the jury instructions?
I think that does fit with the jury instructions, that there's no, for instance, indication that it has to be possessed for a particular period of time.
This is unintentional possession. The jury instructions is knowingly had this actual physical control.
That's a good point. I think probably the unintentional part, I do think it does have to be an intentional in the sense of a conscious possession.
So
although
the judge's statement about the law is not correct.
Well, I don't know if I would concede that because what the jury instructions talk about is it has to be knowing and conscious. There actually is a strict liability crime. There is no intent element, no criminal intent element per se. So it depends on how you...
Do you think the jury instructions are incorrect?
No, I think that accurately defines possession in and of itself, and it does comport with the theory as strict liability crime. But
so if he was asleep and somebody put it in his hands, that would not be possession.
No, it would not be.
So hurried unintentional possession, the statement that hurried unintentional possession is still possession is wrong.
Well, it depends what the court means by that. Because, again, the word intentional can be meant to imply, I think, a couple different things. If it's strict liability, there really is no culpable intent that's required.
Right.
Does the state have any problem because the record appears to be devoid of the elements of the offense?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The Wisconsin statute that deals with pleas doesn't require that personal colloquy about the elements of the defense, of the offense.
I always thought that Bangor and its progeny suggest that the nature of the offense, you have to advise them of the elements of the offense. They have to be advised of the elements of the offense. It's inherent in the definition of the defendant understanding the nature of the offense.
Your Honor, I'm not particularly sure about that part of Bangor Day.
Okay, I'm not either.
I know that, again, I would focus on, clearly the elements were not gone through. However, the plea questionnaire, again, does say that that's something that defense counsel discussed with the defendant, that he's aware of the elements of the offense. And I guess that's where I take issue with my opponent, is in the duty of the trial court here. It's really not to do what the defense counsel's obligation is, to go through the plea questionnaire in intimate detail. But
97108, I think, that says that the court shall personally, doesn't it? I can't remember, but I think it does, with regard to the nature of the offense. I mean, now that's been interpreted, attaching him to the plea questionnaire is okay, but I thought that's what it said.
Although I think in Thomas even, this court made it pretty clear that doesn't require any particular colloquy with the defendant as to the factual basis. It just means that the court has to personally determine in some way develop the record, draw from some set of facts, and make sure that that set of facts would establish the crime if those facts were proven. Again, our view is it doesn't require some parsing of inconsistent statements or reference to other matters beyond what the party's stipulation is.
That can include an inquiry, a personal inquiry by the trial judge of the defendant that he has gone over the plea questionnaire
exactly
with his attorney. And I think the record reflects that the judge did make that personal inquiry.
That was done in this case, yes. So, and that's our position, is that that certainly is sufficient. And there was no reason, again, if it were a case where there was something specific raised by defense counsel, something that should have triggered some further duty, you know, maybe that would have been a different case, but there just wasn't anything like that here that the judge was, should have caused the judge to do that. And certainly the letter should not have been something, because it wasn't part of the party stipulation.
Thank you. Mr. Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Holtzman. That concludes the argument in State v. Tyron Black, and we are in recess until...